Okay, very good. Okay, so let's continue from where we left off before. So we're looking at the famous Kalama Sutta. At least it's famous these days. I'm not sure if it was famous before, but these days it's very famous. So it's good to have a look at this one here. And the point of the sutta again is, we have these people called the Kalamas who are not really Buddhist, who are confused about which teachings to follow, which teachings not to follow. And the Buddha then gives them some advice on how to decide what teachings to follow. And what is so interesting about this, of course, is that he talks about going back to your own personal experience of things and deciding what should be followed based on that personal experience. And this is the sort of thing that people can relate to in the modern world. People sometimes reject kind of traditional religions, but they can relate to this kind of thing. Be pragmatic, right? Get down to the essence of things. What actually works, that is what is important in any kind of life, certainly in a spiritual life. So this is why he says here, he says that when Kalamas, you know for yourself, these things are unwholesome. These things are blameworthy, right? Unwholesome is almost like unhealthy. They lead to almost like a negative, unskillful is another way of translating that. But it's almost like you get an unhealthy state of mind, right? You can feel the mind sometimes. Sometimes it feels that a particular state is not nice. It feels like it's wrong somehow. It feels almost unhealthy, like anger or negativity or depression or whatever it is. And you compare that to a mind which is pure, which is free of these things, and it feels kind of healthy. There's something positive, something beautiful about the mindset that is pure. So just by feeling these things sometimes, you can know which way to lean, which way is the right way, and which way is the wrong way. It is blameworthy, right? It is blameworthy because these things often lead to conflict, they lead to problems, they lead to unskillful behavior and all of these things. So anger is considered blameworthy in the world. And we all know that we prefer people who are kind, right, who are gentle, who are caring. These are the kind of people we tend to like rather than the angry ones. The people who are always angry, they don't have many friends usually. They get quite lonely after a while. And these things are censured by the wise. Wise people don't like these kind of defilements. Wise people say that gentleness and kindness is the way to go. And of course, the last one here is perhaps the most important one. These things, if accepted and undertaken, they lead to harm and suffering. And this, I think, is one of those very important points that was understood very clearly in ancient India at the time of the Buddha, that the purpose of any kind of spiritual life, the purpose of all of these philosophies that existed at that time, always was to lead people towards happiness, to lead people towards suffering, towards something beneficial. This should always be the purpose of the spiritual life, right? In the end, it is a movement towards happiness. And, of course, if it is going to be a movement towards happiness, we should be able to see that movement in our life right here, right now. If it is towards an ultimate goal of the highest kind of happiness, it only makes sense that it should be a gradual movement towards that, where we start to feel the happiness, start to feel the benefits of these teachings straight away if we do it in the right way. And this is what the Buddha says elsewhere. He says that the suttas, the Dhamma is sanditika. It is visible here and now. And part of that, of course, is that the ultimate result of the Dhamma is visible in this life. We can achieve the highest kind of result now. We don't have to wait and after we die. But another idea, another reason why it's sanditika is because we can actually experience right in this very moment some of the benefits of practicing the right way. if you're able in this moment to turn away from a negative mind state and turn towards something positive, you will experience the benefits in this very moment, right? Right now. Not afterwards, but now, straight away. You can see how the Dhamma has that ability to move you towards happiness at any given moment of time. And this is part of what this is about. The idea of a good spiritual teaching should have that effect on you. Be a positive thing. So very practical, right? And very kind of down to earth. Come back to your own experience. And I would recommend you in your Buddhist practice to take this on board. Not so much for finding out what Buddhist teachings are right and what are wrong, but just to remember. If you are practicing in the right way, you should be experiencing the results, right? So you should, sometimes it's good to kind of weigh things up. Where are you at this year compared to last year? Every time you go on a meditation retreat, I don't know, maybe you're coming down to Jhana Grove, or maybe you have a meditation retreat here. This is more like a study retreat. We do a bit of meditation, but a lot of suttas. But when you go on a meditation retreat and you really have time to go into the meditation in a proper way, then compare it. What was it like last year compared to now? Is it better this year? Right? And when you compare it like that, you start to understand whether you are growing in the Dhamma or not. Is it actually moving you towards the happiness, away from the suffering that it is promising? It's important to be realistic about these things. Be very pragmatic. And then you can actually, if it then turns out that actually last year, my mindfulness hasn't improved, right? My meditation isn't going anywhere. I don't feel any more kind-hearted than I did last year. Well, then you ask yourself, why is that the case? Where am I is there a failure in my practice somewhere? And usually you will find that there's something that you can do to remedy that, so that next time you come on retreat, next year, then actually you see a difference in what is going on. And by difference, I always mean an increase in the good qualities and a decline in the bad qualities. You feel less angry and upset about the world. You feel more at ease and relaxed with other people around you. The desires are a little bit reduced, right? You feel more sense of clarity. You don't feel so confused, perhaps, or so restless and all these kind of things. You feel you have a better heart. It's like you feel more kindness and compassion to the people around you. But of course, first and foremost, you feel that your meditation actually is moving forward. You feel that your stillness is becoming more powerful. And these things are things that you can see, especially if you look at it over a long period of time, you should be able to see these things happening. Something should be going on there. And that's why I'm still a monk, right? I've been a monk now for over 20 years. And if it hadn't been for the fact that I was making some progress, I don't know if I would still be a monk. I might have given up by now. But the fact that you are going somewhere, it feels very meaningful. It feels that you are living your life to some purpose, right? Most people don't go anywhere. Most people start out here. When they die, they are same place pretty much in terms of their mind state and mindfulness and all of these things. Sometimes they're down here. When they die, they started up here and they go down, right? This is really terrible when you die lower than when you started out. Oh, imagine when you die, you think, oh no, I wasted my life. I did all the stupid things and now I've gone backwards in my life. Ideally, we want to be up here, right, when we die. We started and then we look back, we think, wow, I used my life in a good way. If all we do is mess around, if all we do is enjoy the sensual pleasures of the world, if all we do is kind of chase status and we chase promotion in work and all these kind of things, those things are not going to make any difference when you die, because you have to give it all up. It is the spiritual part of your life that makes a difference when you finally die. And that is where you find real meaning. The rest of the stuff is meaningless when you come to your deathbed. So don't do the meaningless stuff. Do the meaningful stuff, right? It's meaningful. Whoa, then you feel that you are there. I'm not saying that you shouldn't enjoy yourself. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have a career. Please do so. But make sure you have a career in the right way, with the good qualities, so that you actually, something happens in your life. Then you don't feel that you have wasted your time. It's a short life, right? Human life, 80 years, 90 years, sometimes only 70, 60 years. It is short. We don't have that much time. We have to spend it well. Otherwise, it feels like meaningless and pointless after a while. Okay, now Jerry has been very kindly made me a cup of coffee, so I'm going to take advantage of that. Thank you very much. So, very good upatags. Upatak is a Pali word for attendant, somebody who attends on you, kind of someone who gives you coffee, right? That's upatak. That's great. Okay, so if it does all of these things, leads to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. Then you should give them up. And you should forget about all the other stuff, regardless how logical it seems or whatever. If it leads to harm, it's bad, regardless of the logic. That's what he's saying here. And then he goes on to draw out some of the implications of this. And he says, what do you think, Kalamas, when greed or anger or delusion, when these things arise in a person, is it for his welfare or for his harm or her welfare or for her harm? For his or her harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a greedy, angry, deluded person, overcome by greed, anger, and delusion, with mind obsessed by it, destroys life, takes what is not given, transgresses with another's wife or husband, and speaks falsehood, and he or she encourages others to do likewise. Right? So this is the problem with these things. These things are called in the suttas the hetu or the mula. The mula is like the root of action. And in English, we would call it the motivation. These are the things that motivate you, right? If you feel very angry, you feel compelled sometimes to do things. Anger almost forces you to act. Now, you've got to talk to that person. Why? Because they did something bad. Okay, oh, and you're angry with that person, right? Or you're very greedy. You've got to act on that now. The greed drives you to, you have to have that extra ice cream. Or that's only small greed, right? But sometimes big greed, much worse than that. You've got to do it. So you are compelled by these things, and they drive you forward. And what do they make you do? They make you do all of these bad things. And of course, what you can see there, those bad things are essentially the four of the five precepts, right? You destroy life, you steal, you commit adultery, and you speak falsehood. Four of the five precepts. So what happened to the fifth one? Where is it? Has it been lost? Is the text dodgy? Is it a dodgy text, you think? Is it kind of been somebody, or maybe some monk thought that, you know, alcohol is a good thing. Let's just erase it from the text, right? Is that possible? This is what happens sometimes in transmission. Transmissional text is not 100% reliable. So imagine that there is a monk who likes to drink, right? And think, okay, take out that precept. Okay, erase it. Transmit from one generation to the next one. No, it's interesting, isn't it? That it's not. I don't think that has happened, because obviously it occurs elsewhere in the suttas. But it's interesting that it isn't mentioned, right? The drinking or the using alcohol and intoxicating things is not part of it. And this is actually something that you see in the suttas in the number of places, is that the first four of the five precepts is what is mentioned the most often. And the idea of not drinking or using intoxicants is not actually mentioned that often. And the reason for that is that these things, these four precepts here, these are the things that actually are unwholesome conducts in their own right. Drinking as such is said to be unwholesome because it tends to lead to the breaking of the four other ones. In itself, it is not such a terrible thing. In itself, it also has negative consequences, but it's not directly unwholesome in the same way as the first four precepts. It doesn't mean that you can drink as much as you like, right? Ajahn Ramali said, you can drink, it doesn't matter as long as you kind of are kind afterwards. Please, if you said that, it would be terrible. I would feel really embarrassed if that were to happen. So please don't think that. I think drinking is still obviously very important in many different ways, but it's not directly unwholesome in the same way that this is. An important thing to keep that in mind. That's why it is mentioned right here. And there is another thing here which is interesting, and this is the idea that you encourage others to do likewise, right? And this, I think, is a tendency in human beings. If we do bad things ourselves, we feel better if other people also do bad things. Somehow we have rationalized the idea that stealing or killing or lying or committing adultery or whatever, we have rationalized it for ourselves. Yeah, it's okay, you know, you've got to do these kind of things. Life is hard sometimes, and sometimes, you know, if you do it in the right way, it is not so bad, etc. So because we rationalize these things for ourselves, we also tend to kind of talk positively about these things to others, right? And somehow we feel better if other people do the same thing. Oh yeah, they. You know, you always hear somebody when you point out to somebody they're doing something wrong. Yeah, but other people do it as well, right? That's the kind of thing that you often hear. They will rationalize it in that way. Just because other people do it, then it's okay if I do it. So it's almost like you tend to encourage other people. But in Buddhism, this is one of the bad. This is actually bad karma, to encourage other people to break the precepts and do bad things. Is actually bad in its own right. And that's why here it is specifically mentioned as a separate thing, that you encourage other people to do bad things actually is bad. Or just speaking in praise of these things, right? Even if you don't encourage them, speaking in praise of doing bad things, that also is bad. So one of the great ways of making good karma in this world is to encourage people to do good things, right? So I hope I'm making good karma. Am I encouraging you to do good things? I hope so. So maybe I'm making good karma. Hooray, I'm making good karma. Great. So I'm really happy about that. And this is a thing that you can also do in your life. If you are, you know, you are kind of linked in with other people in various ways. You will be a family member. You have your parents, your children, your spouse, or your whatever it is, right? And we have some ability to influence those people in our life. And by doing that, we are actually creating good karma. Or you influence each other here in the Buddhist in the BGF, right? You support each other in the right way. You help each other in finding ways. Or somebody says, "Oh, I find this precept really hard to do. How can I keep it?" And then you encourage them and you tell them how you did it because you had the same problem or whatever it was. Everybody's drinking. You've got to drink in business, right? If you don't drink in business, think you're crazy. How can I get out of that? And then you find a skillful way of getting out of drinking, even though you have some kind of business that you have to deal with. So this is a good thing about having spiritual companions that can guide you in the right way. But remember, it's tricky to guide people, right? It's very easy for these things to backfire. If you push people too hard, if you push your children, say, "Children must do this." Sometimes the children will rebel. They're not going to listen to you because it is the nature of, we don't want to be pushed too much. If we feel that we are being pushed too much, it's almost as if we feel that we have no mastery of ourselves. The world around us is always forcing us to act in a certain way, and we have no self-mastery. And if you really feel that you have no self-mastery in your life, that often can lead to depression, right? You're always kind of being bossed around by everybody around us. You have no mastery of your own life. And it feels terrible, and sometimes that can lead to depression. People who feel that the world is conspiring against them, they're always suffering, they have no mastery over their own life, that is one of those states that leads to negative states of mind and sadness and these kind of things. So it's important that people feel a sense of self-mastery, and for that reason we shouldn't push people too much. You have to be skillful in how we encourage others. I remember when I first became a Buddhist monk, my parents felt it was terrible becoming a Buddhist monk. "We have done so much for you, nice education, we have supported you, paid for all your education, everything. And now you want to do what? Become a Buddhist monk? You're crazy. What is this all about?" They had no idea about Buddhism, right? They thought it was some kind of crazy cult or something like that. And of course, when I became a monk, I thought, yeah, okay, now this is it, right? Buddhism, this is the best teaching, everything else is nonsense, this is it. That's kind of what you think. You become very zealous, right, when you start out in the beginning. Go back to my parents, say, "Okay, parents, listen, this is the truth, right? Put everything else aside, this is the way." This is the last thing you should do with your parents. It's never going to work. It's absolutely impossible. But what works, I realize, is that over time, you just keep on doing the right thing. You just shut up. Don't try to convert your parents. Just shut up. Just do the right thing. Live in the good way. Be a good example for the people around you. Be a good example for your family. And after a while, they start to see that there's something good going on with you. They come to visit you in Perth. My parents came to visit me at Bodhinyana Monastery a few times. And after a while, they start to kind of, oh, there's something going on here, something positive going on here. And after a while, instead of you going to them and teaching them, they come to you and say, well, let's hear about this, right? We want to hear a little bit about meditation practice and about Buddhist teaching, that sort of thing. Then you have won the battle, right? And you know you have succeeded with this. But this is what you have to do. If you want to teach other people, you have to do it in the right, in a skillful way here. And not coming across as somebody, because sometimes it comes across, it's like you are the needy one. You need to convert other people. If the other people feel that you are the needy one, you need to convert them, they are going to reject you. But if they feel that you are coming from kindness and compassion, then they will listen, right? They have my best interest at heart. Of course, then they will listen, and then they will be willing to see what you have to say. So this is the right way of encouraging others. So be careful about this. Do it in a skillful way, and then it's great and wonderful. It's a bit like Ajahn Brahm, right? He never pushes you. He just sits down and gives a funny talk and tells a few jokes, right? And then but you have the feeling that he has your best interest at heart. He never tells you that you have to do anything in particular. And then, of course, it becomes more easy to follow those teachings as a consequence. Okay. So all of these things, they lead these bad roots. They lead to problems, and that's why they are bad. So. The Buddha says, will that lead to his harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So they all understand that when you do bad things, it leads to harm and suffering. And this is one of those things that is very important to understand in the Buddhist teachings, or in any teaching, or in any life. If you do bad things to others, it has bad ramifications for yourself. And I think that if we understood this fully enough, completely, then we would never do anything bad. Because it comes back to us again. It always has a detrimental effect on us, when for us and for the other person. And the more deeply you see that, the more ability you have to understand how these things actually affect you, then the more moral, the better person you will be as a consequence. And it's actually not that hard to see these things. If you are smart and you are sharp and you have enough mindfulness, then all you really have to do is to feel what happens when you do something which isn't kind. Feel inside of you the immediate effect of doing an act which isn't kind. Even thinking a thought which isn't kind, what is the immediate effect of that? And it feels yucky inside of you. It feels kind of slightly shameful. It feels like you are dragging yourself down into the dirt, right? Your mind feels impure. So notice that. And when you notice that, you understand that every time you do something slightly bad, a little bit bad like that, you're dragging yourself down. The more bad things you do, the more you accumulate that, the darker and the more negative your mind becomes. So feel that for yourself. Right, it becomes a very, when these things are seen, just like the Buddha is talking about here, it becomes a very powerful source for understanding. Never try to avoid all kinds of bad conduct all the time, essentially, is what it is about. And of course, the opposite with the good actions, right? You feel the effect of good actions. You feel the effect of kindness and generosity. Sometimes you feel a sense of joy, do something kind. And then if you build up those goodnesses more and more and more, you're purifying the mind, cleaning out the mind, right? And then, of course, the good things come as a consequence. So this personal experience, so important in the Buddhist teachings. So it leads to suffering, so be clear about that. And what do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Unwholesome, Bhante. They're unwholesome. They lead to a lack of purification, you feel dirtied by these things. Are they blameworthy or blameless? They are blameworthy. And the person who is going to blame you the most is yourself. You're going to say, oh no, I shouldn't have done that. That was a bad idea. Why did I do that? That was a mistake. Right? This is how things tend to go if you do something stupid. So they are blameworthy. You are the number chief person in blame, to blame yourself afterwards. Censured or praised by the wise. Censured or criticized by the wise. Accepted and undertaken. Do they lead to harm and suffering or not? How do you take it? Accepted and undertaken. These things lead to harm and suffering. So we take it. So, kamkalamas. Now we're jumping a bit ahead in the sutta. Kamkalamas. Do not go by oral tradition, by the lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation. Not sure why he uses this kind of words. It's almost reasoned cogitation. Anyway, by acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our teacher, our guru. But when you know for yourself, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. So again, the same idea again. What do you think, Kalamas, when non-greed, non-anger, and non-delusion arises in a person? Is it for his welfare or for his harm? For his welfare, Bhante. So, why does it say non-greed, non-anger, non-delusion? Right? It's kind of slightly strange, isn't it? It's almost as if, you know, it sounds kind of neutral, but of course the point here is that there are many ways in which you can have non-anger, and all of these ways are positive from a Buddhist point of view. And very often non-anger means metta, it means kindness, it means a sense of care for the people around you. That is a very important aspect of non-anger. It sounds a bit better, right? Loving kindness sounds better than non-anger. Non-anger sounds kind of okay. So that is all part included in non-anger. But the point is that on the Buddhist path, you can go a long way. And when you go all the way to the very deep stages of samadhi, you get to these things they called upekkha, the equanimity, the evenness of the mind. And this is also non-anger, right? You don't actually have metta actively or compassion actively at that time. Nonetheless, you have non-anger. And that upekkha, of course, also is a very positive state of mind. And this is why they use this kind of terminology, non-anger, non-delusion and non-greed, because it encompasses more than just the ordinary metta or renunciation or wisdom, if you like. It encompasses all these other things as well. So these things arise for your benefit, because then you can be kind, you can see things as they actually are. And it's very strange, you know, I think that people generally, they want to be kind in the world. I think there's something about almost everyone. We know something deep inside of us, that kindness and caring for others actually leads to happiness. I think we all know that in a certain sense. And that is why it is such a tragedy when people don't care for each other, but not kind to each other. Because what it really means is that even though they know deep inside that they have caring, kindness leads to happiness for themselves and others, they're not able to do it. There's something inside of them blocking them from being kind, right? The conditioning is so strong. They have been brought up in such a way, gone to have certain friends or whatever it is. The conditioning is so strong that even though they know they should be kind, they can't stop themselves and they do things that are unkind. So remember that when you see people doing stupid things, don't judge them. Feel sorry for them, right? They are in a terrible state. It is so, they have been drawn, they have been conditioned in such a way they are not able to do acts of kindness, even though they know deep inside that kindness is the right way to go. And of course, how do you feel about that? You have to feel compassion, right? That's the only logical way when you see that. Even though that negativity, that harshness, or whatever it is directed towards you, they are the ones that are in trouble because they are unable to be kind, even though they know that kindness is the right way to do things. So just little tricks like that is sufficient to change you around and start make you look at the world in a different way and kind of look at people in a different way. This has tremendous beneficial effects for yourself and also, of course, for the people around you when you're able to see things in this way. It means that you start to, the way you deal with people changes dramatically as a consequence. So, kalamas. A person without greed, without anger, without delusion, not overcome by greed, anger, and delusion, his mind not obsessed by it, does not destroy life, take what is not given, transgress with another's wife or husband, or speak falsehood, nor does he or she encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to his welfare and benefit for a long time? Yes, Bhante. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? They are wholesome. They are healthy. They feel good inside. You feel that the mind is in a healthy place. Things are right. Are they blameworthy or blameless? Blameless. You're not going to blame yourself, right? You're going to say, well done me. I'm doing well. Right? That's how you're going to feel about yourself. Isn't that a nice way to feel about yourself? Whoa, I'm living well. You feel that you're living well. Oh, I'm living well. I'm doing the right thing. You feel good about yourself. You don't build up your ego. You don't kind of think, yeah, I'm better than all these other idiots, right? That's not what you think. Because if you think that, you're kind of bringing some bad qualities into the goodness. But you just feel naturally good about yourself in a kind of low-key way without really bragging about it or making it to some business. Yay! Censured or praised by the wise. Praised by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken. Do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? How do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things lead to welfare and happiness. So we take it. So now he has kind of led the Kalamas around, right, to understand some basic issues in life. And of course, the point is that although this is, in a sense, a Buddhist way of presenting things, it is a kind of way that makes sense to everybody, right? It's very hard to kind of argue with this. It makes sense to everyone. And this is one of those beautiful things I feel about the Buddha's teaching, that the vast majority of it is just sensible stuff, sensible psychology, a way of looking at the world that is very hard to really disagree with these kind of things. That's why sometimes I feel, you know, I don't know if we really need to call Buddhism a religion. Depends how you practice it. Sometimes we practice a bit as a religion, but it's not really required always. It's really about psychology, how to be happy and how to avoid suffering. And this is what this is all about, coming from direct personal experience, right? Rather than coming from some doctrine or some reasoning or even if a teacher saying so, but actually knowing this through your own experience is what the Buddha is talking about. And that is why the Kalamas are able to take this on board. Right? And presumably they become Buddhist after this, they become disciples. And yeah, this is really good stuff. And then they become kind of the Buddha gradually leading them along, right? Stage by stage. I have left out a part of the sutta again, and now it comes to further down in the sutta, and you can see now we are coming to the metta part of the sutta. And so, as I was just saying, the Buddha is leading them along, right? Making them understand these issues. And then gradually they get kind of brainwashed by the Dhamma. Is that good? Wholesome brainwashing, right? Good brainwashing, exactly. So you have to, if you're going to be brainwashed, you've got to be brainwashed by something good. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So get the right kind of teaching here. Okay, so let's see what he has to say here. Then Kalamas, that noble disciple who is thus devoid of longing, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, ever mindful, dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, with mudita, with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, and without ill will. So, here he calls the person a noble disciple. I'm not sure whether that, strictly speaking, means an Arya in this context or just a good disciple. These words have kind of have a range of meanings. But that, obviously, we're talking about somebody very wholesome here, devoid of longing. I think Abhijja, I'm not sure what the word is here in the Pali. I wasn't able to check it up beforehand, unfortunately. But probably just means roughly without any kind of desire, sensual desire, without ill will, unconfused, right? Clearly comprehending. We're talking about these things before. The idea of sampajanya, what that means in the suttas. You have clarity about what you're doing. You know you're heading in the right direction. You understand the purpose and the suitability of what you're doing. And you are mindful. Here comes that word mindful in again. Yeah, and you see this whenever the Buddha is talking seriously about meditation practice, whether it is about Satipatthana, as we saw yesterday, whether it is about mindfulness of breathing, we haven't looked at mindfulness of breathing yet, but we will later on, or it is here about the Brahma Viharas, everywhere he uses this word mindfulness. Mindfulness always has to be established before meditation really can take off. So why is it that mindfulness is so important? Why is it always required? What is the reason for that? And the reason, of course, is very simple, because mindfulness, one of the meanings, mindfulness means a few different things. The Pali word is sati. Sati can mean memory, right? The ability to recall things that happened a long time ago. But the other important meaning of sati in the suttas is this ability to stay in the present moment, just to be aware of what's happening here. And I'm sure many of you will know what that means, right? Sometimes in a minute, the mind is all over the place, but other times the mind becomes peaceful, and you have this ability to be aware of what is happening here. And so we all have some idea what sati is about. When some of you were complaining about thinking too much, but even when you think a lot, there are moments often where the mind becomes clear. And the way, you know, a teacher does that, I like the way Ajahn Brahm does it traditionally. He says to be able to be aware of the thinking mind, right? As soon as you stop like that, you halt, and that is where kind of the mind becomes quiet, because you're waiting for something to happen. And that is how you know what mindfulness is, at least to a tiny little degree, because the mind at that point has stopped, basically. And it is so important, mindfulness, because if you haven't got that mindfulness, it means that the reason why you haven't got mindfulness is because the defilements are still in charge in the mind. Usually desire, usually ill will to at least a little bit of a degree. And as long as they are there, they will tend to drag your mind into the past and into the future. Right? And as long as your mind is being dragged around by the defilements, it's impossible to do any meditation, because meditation, by its very nature, is about staying with the meditation object. So you cannot do that. It's only when mindfulness is established, which means the defilements are already very low at this particular point, then you are able to stay with the meditation object, because these things that drag you into the past and the future, they have largely disappeared. Then meditation becomes possible. This is why mindfulness always needs to be present for meditation really to happen. So one of the most important things in meditation practice is this ability to give rise to mindfulness, to sit back and wait for the mind to kind of come to that sense of peace. Right? I'm going to talk more about this later on, how we give rise to mindfulness. Most of the ways of giving rise to mindfulness is all the stuff we do in our daily life. If we live our daily life in a skillful and wholesome way, then mindfulness will tend to arise when we sit down to meditate. Sometimes it takes a long time, right? We have to suffuse, to imbue that mind with all these good qualities. And after we have done that for years, not as many years, right? And you do it again and again and again. You understand that every time you do a tiny bad action, it drags you down. And because you understand that it drags you down, you become so scared of doing anything bad. You stop saying even the smallest bad thing to the people around you. You become this very good-hearted person because you understand the danger of these things. You are destroying your own future, destroying your own life. Every time you do something bad, every time you think a bad thought, it will have a long-term negative consequence for you. And understanding that drives you in a different direction, moves you forward, encourages you to live more mindfully, more clearly, more compassion, more kindness to the people around you. And there are ways of doing this so that to enable us to actually do these things more easily. So mindfulness is so crucial, right? And this is where it comes from. In the end, it comes from the kindness in our heart, our good heart. But that is really where it comes from. And this is why this whole sila thing is so fundamental to the all of the Buddhist path. Every meditation practice, everything we do, it is absolutely crucial. I'm going to drink my coffee mindfully. Okay. And then, once you are mindful, that is when this possibility starts to actually follow and to actually focus on these meditation objects. Right? Here we are talking about loving kindness, metta, which is just friendliness or goodwill, if you like, to all the beings around you. And then you pervade, which means like you suffuse, right? One quarter, one direction with that mind fulfilled, filled with loving kindness. And very often you need quite strong mindfulness. Ideally, you already have samadhi before you do this. That is usually when this becomes possible. One of the things that you find in the suttas that the Brahma Viharas very often come after the jhana states. Why? Because once you have jhana, once you have really good samadhi, then the Brahma Viharas become almost automatic. So then metta becomes very much more easy to do, actually quite easy after a jhana, but before that it becomes much more difficult. But at least if you have mindfulness, you can start to do these kind of things. If you haven't got mindfulness, it becomes very hard. So imbue, you pervade that quarter, right, with this beautiful mind of goodwill, wishing all beings in the world, wishing them well. And then you do the same thing with the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter, everywhere, above, below, across, and everywhere. And then you have this little thing, to all as to himself. And the Pali word is sabbatataya. And this is an interesting word because it probably does not mean to all as to himself. That's probably not correct. There's a very interesting paper written about this by Venerable Annalaya, the one who wrote the Satipatthana books and these kind of things. He basically makes the point that this word occurs in two different ways in the Pali Suttas. Sometimes there is double T-A, sometimes double T-H-A. And these two words, that little H makes a big difference in the meaning for the word. So he did a major research study comparing it with how this word is used in the Chinese agamas, how it's used in the Sanskrit, how it is used in the Pali. And he came to the conclusion that actually the TTH is wrong. No, sorry, TTA is wrong. Probably is TTHA. And that changes the meaning of the word, and it just becomes another word, which means like everywhere, all around. That is really what that word means, according to him. And I think he's right about this, because it was a very persuasive paper. that he wrote about that. And that's interesting, right? Because we are often taught when we do metta meditation, often to start with ourselves. May I be happy and well. This is a standard method found in places like the Visuddhimagga, Suddhimagga written by Buddhaghosa in the 5th century. And it may be that Buddhaghosa himself was led astray by this particular problem with this word. It is very likely that this word goes back a long way, the problem with this particular word. So a lot of the way that metta is often taught seems to be based, quite likely, on the misunderstanding of this particular word in the suttas. It's amazing, isn't it, how sometimes tiny little things like that can have a very large effect. So what this means in practice is that the idea of starting off with having metta towards ourselves does not seem to be what actually is recommended according to the suttas. What is recommended in the suttas is just to have metta towards everybody. And when you have metta everywhere, that includes yourself, obviously, because you are part of everywhere, right? You are somewhere. If you are somewhere, you must be part of everywhere. So you're part of this. So you become part and parcel of this thing. And I don't know about you, but many people find it a bit strange to do metta towards themselves. It's kind of hard to do that. But if you are just part of everything, it actually becomes often much easier. But again, it doesn't matter so much. It doesn't mean that if you have done it towards yourself that you have gone really badly astray and you're now going to reborn in a bad destination because you did metta to yourself. That is not what it means, right? The important thing in Buddhism, again, like the Buddha was saying just before to the Kalamas, is that what works is important. If it works, if you're able to give rise to the feeling of metta, that is the most important thing here. If you do it towards yourself and that works for you, great, no problems at all. It is just that that is not perhaps the way that the Buddha originally laid down the metta teaching according to the suttas. And that is really all it is. Often these things don't really make that much difference as long as the method works for you. But what you can do, if you find that the method works even when you do it directly towards yourself, you can try to see how does it work if you don't do that. And you kind of more spread it out into all directions instead and see how this actually functions. So, of course, there is also the other important difference here, and that is that this type of metta that we're seeing here is a very elevated form of metta, the kind of metta which happens, as I said before, often after you do the samadhi practice, after you have gone into jhanas or whatever. And sometimes when we haven't really got to that level yet, which is the vast majority of people, often we can use some other technique, such as the one that you find in the Visuddhimagga, whereby you spread it out to somebody who you, somebody who is like your friend, right? Somebody who you admire for the spiritual qualities or whatever, and you kind of expand it from there. That is another possibility. So in the end, it is a pragmatic thing, and whether it works or not. But it's worthwhile remembering that this is how the Buddha teaches this in the suttas. So that is and a small, interesting little point for you. You do it, you dwell pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with metta, vast, exalted, measureless. This idea of having no limit, right? Limitless, no kind of end point. There is nobody excluded from your metta. Right, sometimes we think, oh yeah, metta for the whole world except for that one person. I'm not going to have metta for them. No way I'm going to have metta for that one person. So here they're saying that is the wrong way. Measureless, no boundary, without limits. Everybody has to be included. You will find that that is a very different mind state, to have metta to absolutely everyone compared to having some people that you exclude a little bit. So bring everybody on board. It is, as a Buddhist, we should have no enemies, right? It is so important in life not to have any enemies at all. We should make everybody our friends. Everybody, we should have sympathy and compassion for absolutely everyone, even if they are the worst terrorists suicide bomber or whatever they are, still we need to have some kind of compassion and understanding for them. When you do that, when you have no enemies in your life, it doesn't matter whether they are your enemy. That's their problem, right? If they don't like you, okay, whatever. It's their problem. But at least you will have a sense of compassion and understanding for them. That is so important in this Buddhist life. And then that is when your morality again gets really purified, when you have absolutely no enemies in the world. It's a beautiful way of living life when you feel that, everyone, in a sense, is potentially your friend in this entire world. So measureless again, without enmity and without ill will. Then you have compassion, right? Then you have the altruistic joy, the mudita, and you have the equanimity. It is interesting that in the suttas, it is always in the same sequence. Loving kindness, metta comes first, then compassion, then mudita, then equanimity. Why is that? For example, why is it the case that loving kindness comes before compassion? Very often we hear a lot about compassion in the Buddhist teachings. And I think the reason is that compassion, remember, is about seeing the suffering of other people and wanting to help them out of suffering. That's what compassion really is about. But when you have that kind of attitude, that kind of perception of other people, it's very easy to see the suffering too much. And if you see too much of the suffering, sometimes if you're not ready, if your mind isn't strong enough, it will drag you down and you may feel sad, right? I hear many people say they try to do metta and compassion practice and they feel sad as a consequence. Oh, all these beings, it's so terrible. I have to see all these beings suffering and visualize this. And they can't really do it properly. And this is why metta is so useful, because metta is the focus. Instead of focusing on the suffering of beings, you're focusing on the good qualities of other beings. And when you see the good qualities in others, you're kind of rejoicing in the good things in other people. The only thing that comes from that is good feelings inside of you. So try that first of all. Always try, first of all, to look at the good qualities in the people around you. Of course, if you're part of a Buddhist group like the BGF, it's great, right? Because here you have so many good friends, so many good people. Okay, they may not be perfect, no doubt they do silly things every now and again, but well-intentioned people who want to do the very best in their life. What a great blessing it is to have people like this as your friends, as your supporters, as your Kalyana Mittas, right? It's such a wonderful thing. So you focus, you look upon your Kalyana Mittas in the BGF or anywhere else, right, wherever they may be, and see the good qualities in them, and that is always going to have a very positive effect on your mind. And that is why I think metta comes before karuna, because metta never has a negative effect. It is always something that lifts you up and brings you up and brings you forward. Then there is mudita. Of course, mudita is a rejoicing in other people's well-being and in their success on the Buddhist path. When you hear somebody having a good meditation, say, hooray, well done, friend. Wow, I'm so glad for you. If you can do this, it means I can do it too, right? Because we're all human beings. And you kind of rejoice in other people's happiness and well-being. And then the last one is upekkha. Upekkha is the highest one. That is the one that comes from the fourth jhana and these things. It's the very, very high, when you go beyond, in a sense, all feeling. Right, as I was saying yesterday, the fourth jhana is where you get this equanimity that is more pleasurable than the highest positive feeling. With compassion, with metta, there's still a lot of pleasant feeling there. That disappears completely when you go to upekkha. This is why this is the highest one of these four. So if there's anything you should focus on here, I would say focus on the metta. That is the most important one. And if you can do that, it's great. Then the Buddha goes on. This noble disciple Kalamas, whose mind is in this way, without enmity, without ill will, undefiled and pure, has won four assurances in this very life. The first assurance he or she has won is this: if there is another world, and if there is the fruit and result of good and bad actions, it is possible that with the breakup of the body after death, I will be reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Right? And remember here, he's talking to the Kalamas. The Kalamas don't know anything. They don't have any teachers. They don't have any. They're not religious. They don't have any teachings they follow. So they don't know about whether there is another world or not, right? One person will come and say, oh yeah, after death, you're going to be reborn in this world. Other person said, ah, forget about rebirth. There is no rebirth, just like you hear today. That's so here the Buddha is saying, well, forget about that. It doesn't matter if there is another world or not. Either way, it will be positive for you that you have practiced in this way. Either way, actually, it doesn't say either way. It says simply here that if there is one, then of course you will go to a good destination afterwards. It's further down that it says either way. You are safe, right, if there is another world. And I think that you will know that for yourself, that when you really feel kind of goodness towards the world around you, you kind of feel safe. Right? It's almost as if death isn't really an issue anymore at that point. It's almost as if you know in your heart that now you're going to go to a good destination. It almost feels like that because your sense of yourself is so positive. But of course, what is interesting here as well is I was just saying before about how some people say the Buddha took on board the view, ancient view in India, that there is rebirth. He just took it on board because it was part of the culture. Well, right here he's saying, if there is another world, and the next paragraph says, if there is no other world. So obviously the Buddha had thought about these things, right? These were things that actually existed. So that whole argument right there, and this is the Kalama Sutta. This is the sutta they keep on quoting. And in that sutta, the Buddha already says that he has both ideas are already there in him. Both the idea of no other world and the idea of another world. So it kind of becomes silly, that entire argument. But then you are safe, right, if there is karma and rebirth. If there is no karma and rebirth, the second assurance he has won is this. If there is no other world, if there is no fruit and result of good and bad deeds, still right here in this very life, I maintain myself in happiness without enmity and ill will, free of trouble. So it's good in this life, and it is good in the next life, if there is one. Having loving kindness always has a very powerful positive effect on you. The third assurance he has won is this. Suppose evil comes to one who does evil. Then, when I have no evil intentions towards anyone, how can suffering or evil afflict me, since I do no evil acts? So this seems to be just a variation on the idea of karma. Bad stuff comes to one who does bad things, right? Evil, papa in Pali, just means bad things come to you. So this is just a variation on the same thing. So if you have no bad intentions, if all your intentions are pure, it feels like suffering cannot afflict you. Yeah? And the fourth assurance he has one of this. Suppose evil does not come to one who does evil. And then right here, I see myself purified in both respects. In the sense that he doesn't do any evil, and no evil comes to you. So you're purified in both senses. That seems to be the meaning of this right here. So, the Buddha is kind of getting them around that from a purely pragmatic point of view, a purely kind of reasonable point of view, he's bringing them around to this idea that compassion, kindness, living life in a good way is important and it works. So the purpose of this sutta is not that we should always kind of reject things and we should never have any faith and confidence in anything. This is not the purpose of the sutta. The purpose of the sutta is to lay some kind of foundation to show how to act if there is nothing that we have faith and confidence in. If there is no particular teaching that kind of appeals to us, how do we even get started in the world, right? Who should we believe? And then we come back to our personal experience. But of course, if you have found out that the Buddhist teaching is something powerful and useful in your life, if you found out this actually works through your own experience to some extent, then of course there is certainly room for faith and confidence on the Buddhist path. right? After a while, you get really excited about this Buddha's teaching. You think, well, this is actually really powerful stuff. How can I not have faith and confidence in this? I know that it works. I know people who have practiced this path a long way that have been transformed by practicing this path. Right, so of course I need to have some faith and confidence. So after a while, after some time, after you have kind of taken the initial steps, then of course faith and confidence is not only necessary and important, it is crucial for the blossoming and of the path into the future, so that you actually get the full results of what this path is about. So it's important to see these teachings in the right way. And when you do that, you can use them skillfully also in your own practice. Okay, let's have a break. I'll see you back again around 3:15 here.